I'm about to speak with best-selling author Jonathan Cahn about his brand new book, The Book of Mysteries.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Unlock such mysteries as the portal, the mystery of the eighth day, the Maccabean blueprint, the bridegroom's visitation, the seven mysteries of the age, and much more. Enter a one-year odyssey with 365 different mysteries, one for every day of the year, with The Book of Mysteries by Jonathan Cahn.
You talk about an introduction to get your attention. Oh my. And when it's from Jonathan Cahn, who caused an international stir with his New York Times bestseller, The Harbinger, followed up by The Mystery of the Shemitah, all the more does it get your interest. Jonathan is a personal friend of mine. He's addressed members of Congress in the United Nations. He leads the Jerusalem Center, Beth Israel in Wayne, New Jersey, and is president of Hope for the World, Hope of the World. And his new book, his first new book in 2 years, The Book of Mysteries. Jonathan, welcome back to The Line of Fire, and congratulations on the new book.
Oh, well, thank you, Mike. Always a joy and a blessing to be back with you, and thanks. It's one of the things I look forward to more than any interview is with you.
Awesome. Trust me, I'm thrilled to have you on the air and do these interviews. Before we get into the heart of the new book and just begin to unfold some of the things that you disclose in the book, when we announced that we were having you on and we were featuring the book on radio all this week, there was a lot of excitement. But some said, oh, no, he wrote this book, Mystery of the Shemitah, and all the stuff was supposed to happen last year, and it didn't happen. And, of course, you've answered those questions endlessly. But let's just take 2 minutes set the record straight, as much time as you want on that.
Yeah.
But
sure.
Go ahead.
Okay, first off, I mean, you know, if anybody knows me, anybody's read the books, you know, I mean, I'm always cautious, and I said, here's the pattern, God doesn't have to do anything. I said at every interview, God doesn't have to do anything. You can't put him in a box as far as that, but be ready either way. But beyond that, the actual predominant pattern that's in the Mystery of the Shemitah actually did manifest, and it happened in the last seven cycles, actually now eight cycles, that every time there has been a collapse, whether in the financial realm or the economic realm, it can go back all the way to the 60s, and then you have another cycle in the before that. But what happened: the Shemitah of 2015 was the absolute worst year for the stock market in exactly 7 years since the last Shemitah, since 2008. It was the Shemitah of 2015. Also caused a global collapse in trade, the worst since the Shemitah of 2008. Also, the collapse in the commodity market. Also, in the earnings collapsed, oil collapsed, as you still can see when you go to the gas station. All around the world. In fact, it was the worst year for money all around in 78 years since the 1937, the Shemitah, the last Shemitah of the Great Depression. As far as day crashes, and people tend to look at that, as far as the greatest crashes in history of the world, the top 10. The greatest ones, 20% of them happened in the Shemitah of 2015, and they all happened in the month of Elul, which is that key month as well. On top of the fact, you know, another thing in the book of the Mystery of the Shemitah, it speaks about changes in history or power, and one of the things that happened as well, the American age began in 1871 when America supplanted Great Britain, became the strongest nation, economic power on earth. That age came to an end in the Shemitah of 2015 when now the crown is passed to China. And there's much more. But, you know, so I said nothing has to happen, but the predominant pattern totally did.
Yeah, in quite extraordinary ways when you start to break it down. All right, we come back. I want to talk to Jonathan Cahn and begin to ask him some very specific questions. And what is the Book of Mysteries? And let's get a taste of some of the mysteries, the mystery of the cherubim, mystery of the smicha. What in the world? We'll find out. We come back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Just a quick word, if you miss any part of my one-hour interview with Jonathan Kahn about his brand-new book, The Book of Mysteries, you can order that today. When you get The Book of Mysteries, a beautiful hardcover, you'll also get free this exclusive one-hour interview with Jonathan Kahn, and also free, a book that you cannot buy, my Seven Secrets of the Real Messiah mini book, an eye-opener for you and for a Jewish friend. All right, Jonathan, folks know about the Harbinger. They know about the mystery of the Shemitah. What is the Book of Mysteries?
Well, if the Harbinger and the Shemitah are each revealing of a mystery, or an ancient mystery, the Book of Mysteries is the unlocking of literally hundreds of mysteries. I kind of picture if you were opening up a treasure chest, and really what I believe are the greatest mysteries of God, the mysteries of the age, the mysteries of the rabbis, mysteries of the last days, the prophecy, and all over the spectrum, and also mysteries of one's life and finding one's calling. It's not just, that I believe people are reading already, and not just that people be blown away by the things of God, which is awesome that we should, but also that it transforms our life. And so it's that as well. So some of the titles, things like the Seven Mysteries of the Age, the Mystery of the Secret Angels, How to Alter Your Past, the Mystery of Melchizedek, Entering the Heavenly Dimension, the Seven Mysteries of Your Life, appointed times that, all from, there's no end to God. I mean, and there's no end to the Bible. There's no end to the ways of God. So these are opening these things up, and it kind of does it in a unique way, more like the Harbinger, in that there's a narrative. A man journeys into the desert and encounters a man called the Teacher. And the Teacher takes him on this one-year journey, odyssey, throughout the desert on mountaintops and caverns and chambers of scrolls and all sorts of things in the desert. And every day he opens up another mystery of God to him. So the Book of Mysteries is this journey which really takes the person, the traveler, the man has no name, so it's really the person reading it. You get taken on this journey, and it's 1 year. So therefore, there are 365 mysteries of God, and therefore it kind of exists on several dimensions. One is you could read it right through as a narrative. You could read it right. You can go from one mystery and pick the different mysteries, or it can also be it's a devotional as well, but unlike devotionals before, in that every day is another mystery of God. And because the teacher is giving the student a mission at the end to apply that day, that's really for the reader, that to take it to apply it to your lives. And there are things in there, there are many things in there that, as far as we know, have never been before, and things that came, and some things you'll recognize. But I think, so it exists on all these different dimensions, but it's really to open people's heart, open their lives. And also the other thing is that I feel really strongly, Michael, I'm sure you do, that we're heading to very challenging times for believers, and we have to be strong, and we have to be, and so I was very led to do something that was really going to strengthen people, believers, ground them, help them really overcome, because we have to be even more plugged into God for the days ahead.
Yeah, and it's interesting you use the term mystery, because that's a term that Paul uses referring to something that's in Scripture but was hidden and is now being revealed. He speaks of the mystery of Messiah in us, Christ in you. He speaks of the mystery of Israel hardened in part, but all Israel will be saved. He speaks of the mystery of we'll be all caught up to meet the Lord. So these were things that God had spoken or deposited somewhere in his word, and they are now being revealed at the appropriate time. What was your experience in writing this book? Did you experience that you were going on a journey of discovery as well, and now you're sharing that with your readers?
Yeah, in many ways it was. I mean, most of this was at late at night, as you and I corresponded. I don't say this lightly. I was being ministered to as I was doing it. I felt different every morning. It went from night to the morning. But the morning I felt different every time, and as if this was coming. And it was a long period of time. I mean, it was several months, of course. But there's probably more. Every page, every page is a is another mystery and another day. My biggest challenge was, how do I get this all down? Many of these things could be, many of these pages could be a book in themselves. How do I get it down in a way that can get to the, not just the mind, but the heart? A lot of it, there are things that have been from through the years that the Lord has shown, and things that happened as I was doing the book itself.
All right. So let's plunge in and again, get a sampling. Friends, to get the book, just go to our website, thelineoffire.org. When you order the Book of Mysteries, you'll also get free this interview with Jonathan Kahn and my mini book, Seven Secrets of the Real Messiah. So the mystery of the cherubim. And by the way, I'm doing the interview, but I'm listening with great interest as I'm doing it, as these unfold. So let's start here. The mystery of the cherubim.
Okay. That's one. We know that first of all, when man was expelled from Eden, it says that at the very beginning, it says that God set up the cherubim, stationed them, and with a flaming sword, and that they represented the barrier. You could never get back to God with sin. So this is the absolute barrier to Eden, barrier to God. We don't realize, or people don't always realize this, when God set up the tent of meeting, and you have all the veils originally, and then you have veils, and you have doors, but the veils that he set up also represented this barrier that really goes back to Eden, goes back to the cherubim, but on the veils were cherubim. So when we read that Messiah, when he died or on the cross, the veil was split into, was rent. It wasn't just the veil, it was the cherubim. It was as if, in other words, Messiah was entering through the barrier, represented by the cherubim, pushed apart. Literally, you could say the flaming sword as well. He dies through it, but he opens the way. It's no accident that Messiah on the cross says, "Today you will be with me in paradise." Which is linked, goes all the way back to this. So it's the very first barrier that is there from Eden. It's as if Messiah, and I believe without any question, he's passing through the barrier that was set up all the way from Eden. And there's so many things from Eden that link to Messiah.
Right, and even a lot of the imagery of Revelation is the paradise restored.
Yes,
imagery.
I mean, that's how perfect the Bible is, the Word of God. Who can do something like this over 1,000 years and have it beginning, middle, end? What starts in Eden ends in Revelation.
Yeah, that's the way it unfolds. All right, the mystery of the name of God.
Yeah, well, the first thing is, the first thing I know, and Michael, I know you're aware of so many things, but the what people don't realize in the Hebrew, when it's the very first noun, the very first name in the Bible is God, and it's Elohim, and Elohim, it, first of all, it breaks the rules of regular grammar, and that is that it's a plural, and so in other contexts in the Bible, it actually is translated as gods, But it's Elohim means, it would mean gods, except that it's, Bereshit bara Elohim, God created. The word for create is singular, the word for God is plural. So what does that mean? Well, first, of course, you can see the triunity of God in that. But also, in the Hebrew, when it does that, and there's several other cases of it, when it does that, what it's saying is that the word does not, whatever word you use here, it cannot comprehend, it cannot contain the reality. The reality is so big behind that word that only they have to do it in plural. And so that it's saying that, number one, God is so great, so beyond whatever you think God is, he's more than that. However good you think he is, he's better than that. So there's no end to knowing the all that God has. If Paul could say that I might know, and he's the one who he wrote most of the books of the New Testament, and he could say that I might still know, we have to be seeking him. And that's one of the things in the Book of Mysteries is that we be literally, our whole life is to be a journey, and there's no end to that. Another name of God is, of course, I'll say Yahweh, but YHVH, we don't even know fully how to pronounce it, but the thing is that in the book, the teacher is talking to the disciple, the student, he says, "Do you know the name of God?" And he says, "No, I don't." He says, "No, but you do." And the thing is that he says, "You say it all the time." In order to say something about ourselves, if I say, "I'm Jonathan," I have to say, "I am Jonathan. I am Michael. I am this." I have to put the name of God before I say my name. I have to say, you know, there's not an accident, because our existence comes from His existence. So we, even no matter what I say, even if I say, you know, well, I'm alone. Well, I have to say, I am. I am is with me, with that alone. I am in all things. You know, even if I think I'm, you know, even feeling far from God, I am. So, you know, there's a thing that we think of. I mean, so much application. We think of, you know, we're living to heaven and to God, which we are. But it just as, even more so, is we're to live from God. Every moment is to come from I am. Everything we do, and you have to put I am first in front of your name. He has to be first. But every moment of your life is to come from God.
Mm. All right, friends, we're scratching the surface in this brand new book by Jonathan Kahn, New York Times best-selling author. You've read The Harbinger. You've read Mystery of the Shemitah. Now, The Book of Mysteries, 365 truths unfolded, one per day, or read the whole narrative and dive in a journey of discovery. To find out more, go to thelineoffire.org.
Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm speaking with best-selling author and Messianic Jewish leader, Jonathan Kahn, his brand new book, The Book of Mysteries. Jonathan, you know, and I know, that there's a lot of flaky end-time teaching where people get all caught up with what's going to happen next and this and that, and it's no relevance to their lives. When you and I talk, just sitting down privately, having a few minutes together or over a meal, we're always very sober. I mean, we're both kind of shaken and shaking because of the intensity of the times in which you live. So these issues, and you get into some end times issues in the Book of Mysteries. This is anything but just, you know, interesting information to you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you're right. You know, it's usually many people into prophecy, and we should be. You know, we should be aware of the end times and what and the signs of the times. But there's a lot of sensationalism and, you know, and flaky things as well. Absolutely. But, you know, we are told to be that, and so to be aware. And some of them actually link to what you and I talk about, and actually what you minister continuously. Which, by the way, and I'm not saying this because, but not only are we friends, but I really admire you for what you're doing, Mike. So let me give one of the mysteries of the end times that are in the Book of Mysteries. And there's one called the Apostasia. And at this point, the teacher takes the disciple into the chamber of books and takes up this ancient book. And there's an old illustration of Eden on it. It's fading away, and then there are words fading away. And it opens up the mystery of the Apostasia. What's the mystery? Well, we know the Bible says there'll be a great falling away at the end times, and that's one of the clearest signs actually we see every day around us. We're watching it. Apostasy. We get the meaning, the falling away from the faith, or the falling away from one's stand of faith, and that's absolutely what it means. But there's more to the meaning in this, and there's something that's so relevant to what's happening right now. That is, apostasia also means apo, away from, stasia, the stasis, or the state of, or the state of being. So here's the revelation, that in the same day, last days, when you'll see the falling away from the Word of God, falling away from faith, falling away from Christianity, at the same time you will see the departure from the state of being. What does that mean? That in the same time, the state of creation, man will depart from being, from the state of man or manhood, women departing from the state of womanhood, marriage departing from the state of marriage, family from the state of family, humanity from the state of humanity, and that's exactly what we're witnessing here. And you know, if you look, you think about that the entire creation came into existence by the Word. So if the Word goes, so that state. And we're watching this all the time. Very practical. There's other ones called the fourth creature, which is about Daniel's fourth creature. And there's something in the Hebrew that also goes along with this mystery that actually speaks of a civilization that is artificial, or is that that's unnatural as well. And then there's also good things for the end times as well. You know, there's a polarization. So it goes into all that too, because we need to be aware we are living in the end time.
Yeah, I just wrote an article about a transgender activist, born Robert Arquette, then became Alexis Arquette, but apparently at the end of his life went back to living as a male. And his family was with him as he passes, and his brother says, "You are our brother, our sister, our brother," to paraphrase. And as they're writing about him in the article, they're referring to him and her. He was a great actress. And you think, it's sad. You're reading about someone that's left this world. It's sad to read that anyway. But everything, it seems, is up for grabs. The meaning of marriage, meaning of family, meaning of gender, meaning of humanity. Perception becomes reality. And you wonder, okay, what's next? Can things go after this?
Yeah. How far can you go? Yeah, and it's a spiritual thing. Ultimately, it's if man turns away from God, then it goes back. We exist because of God, and so if we turn away from God, it's going to affect our existence, our nature, the creation, and this is absolute. We're watching this all the time. After Israel re-existence, the surest sign of the end times is literally every day the apostasy we're watching. But every issue we're talking about is linked back to that, and it goes back to the Bible.
And you say there's some positive things because obviously God's a God of light. Light overcomes darkness.
Yeah.
What do you open up in the book that gives hope and encouragement?
Well, one of the things is that it's not just darkness in the end times, it's polarization. The dark talks about evil shall increase, but also talks about the Spirit being poured out. It also speaks about the gospel being proclaimed and a multitude coming to the Lord. So it's polarization in the end times. The dark gets darker, the light is to get brighter. And even if it's maybe more of a remnant, it's even brighter. And the thing is that there's something in the Book of Mysteries called the chiasma. And it refers to, I won't go into the detail, there's a lot in it, refers to a pattern of inverse, that God does things like what's at the beginning is at the end. And so with the age, there's a pattern that what was at the beginning will be at the end. Israel was in the beginning of the age, Israel's back. Jerusalem, back. Jewish believers were at the beginning, disappeared pretty much, and now are back. The church coming back to its roots, church in Israel, that's coming back. But also, an anti-Christian world civilization was then, and it's coming back, and persecution. But you also had the Book of Acts at the beginning. You have to have some form of the Book of Acts at the end. And that's that. And so God, really the last part, and there's another thing I'll just quickly throw in parallels that. Another mystery is that the Hebrew year, God set up the entire Hebrew year as an age. It's something called the seven mysteries of the age. And with that, to keep in mind, it's at the end of the sacred year. Jewish people think often view it as the beginning, but it's the end of autumn, which is the time of teshuvah, which is return and repentance. Therefore, it's at the end, it's not at the beginning of the age that the Jewish people come to get old, but it's at the end that they will return, as a whole. And so the end is also a time of teshuvah, return to Israel, even the church to return. So there is also, there's mysteries of a lot of good at the end as well.
And what kind of responses are you getting from readers as the book is just out, but obviously people are diving right in? What kind of responses are you getting?
Yeah, well, it just came out this past week, I'm not here plugging things. It's incredible. My wife and I were just looking at the thing. The Harbinger and the Sweet of God, great, tremendous reviews. This is getting so much positive, incredible positive things. I was on with somebody who is very famous. I won't mention his name, but every single person knows the person. Actually, everybody in America pretty much knows this person, minister. But and he didn't know what to expect. And he just read the first one, and he started crying on television, and he was moved. So it's not someone. I was just talking to somebody last night, and they're saying it wasn't. It's not just the knowledge of the awesome mysteries are getting blown away, but it's touching hearts as well. So we're getting it. People want to give it to other people, and also, by the way, it's also for unsaved people because it's going to draw them in as well. And there is a salvation call within it because the disciple, in a sense, gets saved. So he at the end tells out. So it's becoming. Some people are reading it as a devotional, but some people are reading it right through. It's so concentrated that it's hard for me to see how you could do that. And then they're reading right through and say, "Well, I got to go back to digest all this." But it's we got incredible responses from every book, but I think this is the most overwhelmingly positive all over. We're just looking at Amazon, but it's been very, very, very amazing.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. Listen, friends, I've got the joy of spending another half hour with Jonathan Kahn talking about this book, and he's doing a ton of interviews. We had to work hard to grab this hour, but you can hear the excitement and enthusiasm in the midst of this. So here's how you can get the entire hour of the interview. We'll send it to you free on a CD for your computer or MP3 player. We'll send that to you absolutely free. And when you order the book, it's a beautiful hardcover. We'll also give you free my mini book that you cannot buy. It's not for sale. Seven Secrets of the Real Messiah. So you'll benefit, you'll be blessed, and we'll be helped as well. Go to the website right now, thelineoffire.org. Hey, holidays are coming. Why not order a bunch as gifts?
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to The Line of Fire. I'm speaking with international best-selling author Jonathan Cahn. His newest book, The Book of Mysteries, 365 Truths, Unpacked, Unfolded, one for each day of the year. Jonathan, let's talk about the mystery of the Smicha. Many people that never heard of the word Shemitah, which is not even a super well-known word in Hebrew in general. Now the whole world knows about that. Smicha, what is the Smicha?
Yes. Yeah, the Smicha is this. That in the, you know, one of the things I want to do is open up things really that you wouldn't see in the original, and but it's there, and or you know, just how awesome the ways of God are. Whenever there's a sacrifice, a sin offering, there had to be something called the smicha, and the smicha is this: is that the priest would, you know, lay his hands, or literally lay his palms of his hands on the head of the sacrifice, identify with the sacrifice, and confess his sins or the sins of the offerer on top of it. Sometimes the offerer, even if it wasn't a priest, could do this. And sometimes, actually, if a sacrifice was dying for more than one, it says in the rabbinical writings that several people, you do a group smicha, you place your hand, identify with the sacrifice, it becomes as you, dies for your sins. Happened on Yom Kippur and other times. Well, if Messiah is the sacrifice and he's the sin offering, then could there have been a smicha? God is so, you know, in the way God works. Well, the first thing is those who offered up the sacrifices were the priests. So it's not an accident that Messiah, you know, we read this all the time, Messiah was taken by the Sanhedrin, which is largely under the authority of the high priest, largely priest there. It had to, because the priest had to offer up the sacrifice, even though they had no idea what they were doing. But what about the smicha? Well, it says that when they pronounced the sin, it says that they all struck him in his head. And what it says in the Greek, it says they buffeted him, or the Greek says with the palms of their hand. According to the smicha, the palms of the priest have to touch the head of the sacrifice before it can be offered up. And the sin has to be confessed over the sacrifice. Well, what about the confession? Well, what happened when this all happened? It's when the high priest, he declared Messiah guilty of blasphemy. Well, according to the mystery, it's not Messiah's sin. It's the sin of the one offering it. It's the priest, that was their sin, and the priests represent Israel, and Israel represents the world. They were confessing the sin of man, blasphemy, man as God, from Eden, onto the head of the sacrifice. The smicha having been done by the priest, then the sacrifice is offered up. And on Yom Kippur, the way it happened is they had two goats that the priest would present in front of a crowd of people. One goat was chosen to be the scapegoat, escapes, and the other is the sacrifice. So what happened with Messiah? It wasn't two goats. It was two human beings, two human lives. Messiah on one side, Barabbas on the other, standing in front of the multitude. And what happened? And there it's chosen. Messiah becomes the sacrifice, and Barabbas, the criminal, goes free. But here's another mystery. In the rabbinical writings at the time of recording what happened at the temple, they said the two goats had to look alike. They had to be identical so you couldn't tell them apart. Well, here's the thing. They had a match. Messiah is he's the Son of God. He's the Son of the Father. Who is Barabbas? Well, that's Greek, but his Hebrew name is Bar Abba, which means the Son of the Father. So even that, there's so much.
You know, the other thing that's wild with that is that some manuscripts also have his name as Yeshua.
So, amazing.
Yeah,
yeah,
so
amazing
that's
with this.
Yeah, so that's the question. Who should I release, this Yeshua called Messiah or this Yeshua called Son of the Father?
Amazing, and you just, and this is another thing, Mike. Other people, what you asked me, what the reaction is. People are also reading it, and they're saying they're getting other revelations, and it's going and going in there. And that's what I didn't know. You know, I've heard that, but I never connected it. And also, at the bottom of every mystery, there's also scriptures and how to get deeper into it. But that's awesome.
Yeah, and the thing is, listen, dig into the Word, friends. When you get the Book of Mysteries, you're going to want to dig deeper. It's going to excite you to read Scripture. Oh, we're just talking about what God intended in His Word, not some secret Bible code. But there's a whole lot in there when you keep reading, digging, that you discover God reveals His truth as we seek Him and ask Him to open our hearts and minds as we study His Word. We'll be right back with more on the Book of Mysteries with Jonathan Cahn.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to The Line of Fire today as I speak with Jonathan Cahn about his brand new book, already a bestseller, The Book of Mysteries. Jonathan, let's just go back a few years when you wrote the Mystery of the Harbinger. When that book came out and suddenly overnight became a New York Times bestseller, a million copies in print, basically the first year or so. I mean, just kind of something unprecedented. You were a first-time author. There was a supernatural story in the publishing of the book. When people asked me about it, I'd say there's no question God's getting our attention and saying, look at what's written there, and is God speaking to us about judgment? The same with Mystery of the Shemitah. When people ask me, well, was that what Moses is writing about? I said, here, the question is, what is the principle? Is there a principle, and is there something here where God's trying to get our attention? Now, as you look back from the day you wrote Mystery of the Harbinger to today, would you say, in your honest judgment, that things are unfolding in our world as expected? They're accelerating. They're not unfolding as expected. Just your own view as the author of these books.
Yeah. Well, we don't know the timing, you know, with God, obviously, and there's everybody has different ideas, but absolutely in this sense that America, you know, the template of the Harbinger is ancient Israel being warned, and they respond with defiance, and that's that scripture, you know, we will rebuild this whole thing. Well, what that scripture is really saying is they're not going to respond. They're going to go away from God, depart from Him even more brazenly than before as they head to judgment. Well, in America, so far, that's exactly what's happening in Western civilization, and particularly America, is we are departing continuously from God. Every day. I mean, and our brazenness, it's almost like, you know, after 9/11, we thought it looked like there was going to be a national revival, people flocking to churches, but there was no repentance. And so instead of getting better, we've gotten worse, which is the same pattern as ancient Israel. And we are, you know, we are continually, it's almost like every day, it's accelerating. It's like a ball rolling down the hill. You know, the apostasy is accelerating. The calling evil good is accelerating. Calling good evil, persecution of Christians, marginalizing is accelerating. I mean, on top of the signs that have continued after the Harbinger, I'll mention something very quickly. I won't go into any detail. But next week, let me put it this way. In the days of the Harbinger, when Israel was falling away from God, they were worshiping another god. The other god was Baal. And next week in New York City, I may even be able to see it. I may go there. They're going to unveil the arch that led to the Temple of Baal. They are erecting it in New York City, of all things. I mean, at this time, of all the very god that was being worshipped at that time.
Yeah, that is extraordinary. Yeah. And there was a lot of talk about that. Was it going to happen? Not happen? And
it was canceled originally, maybe because of the uproar. And now, for those who don't know it, we just found out it's been revived. And they're doing it. And actually, they're doing it near Ground Zero.
Isn't that wild? I mean, look, whatever, you know, people just look at ancient architecture and all that. But of all the ancient architecture and of all places, yeah, I had heard it was canceled and then hadn't even heard that it was revived.
I got word just recently, and then I got the confirmation with the times and everything like that. We can give you reporters something, but it should be next Monday, you know, but crazy. I mean, not even to mention what America did since then, from the Supreme Court in striking down marriage. I mean, we are defying God with a vengeance. That's the template of the Harbinger.
Extraordinary. All right, let's dive in. A few more mysteries from the Book of Mysteries. Again, if you're just tuning in, the brand new book by best-selling author Jonathan Cahn. What about some of the rabbinic writings? Obviously, we have to be careful handling them because there's so much in there and it has to be rightly understood in context. But what do you get into there in your book?
Yeah, and I'm sure, and of course, you know, Michael, you're an expert, but a lot of believers don't know this. There are several things hidden there, and one of them, one of the mysteries is called the Secret of Yoma, and that is that it's from the Book of Yoma, and that is that amazing thing that in the writings of the rabbis, you have actually the record that not just in one place, but several places, that all of a sudden things began to, strange supernatural signs began to take place in the Temple of Jerusalem, indicating some cosmic change, some alteration happened. And when did they put that down? When did they say it happened? They say it happened 40 years before the temple was destroyed, which means it's around, they're pinpointing around the year 30 AD, around there, some cosmic change happened. Well, that just happens to be the time of Messiah coming to Jerusalem, dying and rising as the final sacrifice. And so it's just the doors of the temple opened by themselves as if the way was clear. I mean, that matches, you know, the veil was torn apart. The next partition or barrier was the golden doors of the temple. And there's actually a third witness of that as well. Then, there's a scarlet thread that stopped turning white. You know, at the same time, everything's 30 AD. There's another mystery along that line called the Scepter of Judah that in the book of Sanhedrin, that, you know, the Judge Messiah, in a sense, the book named after them, it gives a time when Messiah had to come according to what they thought he would have to come, and that is also 30 AD. You know, there are things, and again, it's not, we don't look to the rabbis in any way for authority. However, God is sovereign, and it's probably one of the most powerful things that when you have a hostile witness bearing witness to the truth, that's gigantic, you know. And there's also something, there are things in the synagogue, like there is one thing called the Shabbat Mystery Code, and that is that there are things in the liturgy of the Sabbath that actually are prophetic. They don't realize it, but prophetic of what is to come. So there's a whole other world. I mean, even that, God is sovereign over it.
And it's not to say, of course, that the rabbis, these ancient rabbis, secretly believed that they were hiding information, as much as to say that God, who is a sovereign God, caused certain traditions to be passed on and certain truths to be embedded. And even though, you know, there's certain controversy about the exact chronology of when the Messianic Age was supposed to begin, at any reading, it should have begun over 1,800 years ago.
Right.
And the question is, what happened? And, of course, I've shared some of these things over the years in Jewish apologetics. The fact now that a wide Christian audience is going to be exposed to these things is fascinating. Yeah. And let me just tell you, you will not get a big thank you from some of my rabbi friends for
writing this. Oh, Michael, I was expecting a gift in the mail.
No, probably not. All right, let's unfold this one, The Mystery of the Bride and Groom.
Okay, this is one of my favorites. And the other thing is about with the Book of Mysteries, it's not just there are individual mysteries standing on themselves, but there's several streams of mysteries where one mystery then builds onto the next mystery, and then it comes home toward the end of the book. Several of these streams come together, and at the end it kind of goes towards heaven. So this one, in the book, the teacher takes the disciple down to villages of tent dwellers in the desert who are living as if in the biblical times. So they're showing what happened. One of the most amazing, beautiful mysteries to me in the Bible, or the whole thing, is the mystery of the bride and groom, and that is that in the ancient Hebrew wedding or the biblical marriage, it's an amazing picture. It is in a nutshell. What happened is, in order for the bride and groom to come together or marriage to happen, the bridegroom had to make a journey from his house to her house. The journey of the bridegroom had to go there, had to be welcomed in, had to make a pledge of his life to her, had to offer up something called the mohar, a treasure to set her free, and also a sign of his love. If she said yes, they would covenant together, share a cup of wine, pledge each other. They're considered husband and wife. Then he has to leave her, go back to his house, and then they spend a long period of time in separation where they're married, I mean, they're husband and wife, but it's not consummated. He prepares a place for her, and she spends the time preparing herself for the marriage, so getting ready to go. So then comes the great wedding day. The bridegroom, usually at night, comes dressed as a king with his groomsmen all around, torchlight, great procession, one more journey from his house to her house. She's waiting there with her maidens, dressed as a queen, bathed, perfumed, with precious stones. They see each other. She unveils herself face to face. The friends lift them up on a canopy or a sedan chair, carry them away in a great procession from her house to his house. They get to the house of the bridegroom. They're welcomed. They go under the canopy, the chuppah, share a cup of wine again, go off alone and become one. Well, what is the mystery? The mystery is this, and this is ultimately about God and us, and that is God is the bridegroom, we are the bride, or we are born to be the bride. And that's why our whole existence, we need something more. We have to be married, joined in. But according to the ancient mystery, the bridegroom has to make that journey from his house to the bride's house. 2,000 years ago, the bridegroom, God, makes the journey from his house, heaven, to our house, earth, Israel. And he's the God who always journeys to our house. No matter where we are, no matter what our life is, he comes. We have to receive him in. But according to the mystery, he has to make it, he has to offer up a treasure, a gift to set her free. Well, he does, the mohar, but it's not gold or silver, it's his life. We are by that set free. He pledges himself, cup of wine, think of the communion. But then according to the mystery, the bridegroom has to leave the bride, and they have to go back to and prepare a place. So he said, I have to leave now. Messiah said, I go to my father's house to prepare a place for you. So now is the time of the great separation or preparation. He's preparing a place for us. We are preparing ourselves for him. The day will come when he will come. There has to be a second coming of the bridegroom. He'll come this time in glory, not to pledge himself, but to take us into the kingdom, into the bridegroom's house, which on whether we live to see the day in prophecy or whether it happens at the end of our life in heaven, we will finally be home as we enter the house of the bridegroom.
All right, friends, to get more information, to get the book for yourself, the Book of Mysteries, Jonathan Cahn, the author, sharing with enthusiasm these amazing insights into the scriptures and Jewish tradition and more, go to the website, thelineoffire.org. Right there on our website, you'll find a very special resource offer, the book, and this exclusive one-hour interview, and free, a book you can purchase elsewhere, my mini book on seven secrets of the real Messiah.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, we've got time just for one or two more chapters from the book, 365 Mysteries in all. A beautiful hardcover, the Book of Mysteries, brand new by Jonathan Cahn. Again, ordered from our website and get with it free this one-hour interview. And my mini book that you cannot purchase elsewhere, Seven Secrets of the Real Messiah. Well, let's start here. The mystery of the eighth day. This is how you open things up. What is the mystery of the eighth day?
Yeah, the mystery, it's really the most, I would call it the most mysterious day in the Bible, so much so that most rabbis don't even know or say they have no idea what it is. It's the very last day of the sacred year that God appointed. And it's simply called the gathering of the eighth day. And what is the eighth day? Well, you know, seven in the Bible is the number of completion. You know, 7 days in the week, it's finished, finality, and all that. So it's the end. You know, so what is the eighth day? Well, the eighth day is what comes after the end. The eighth day is that which comes beyond the numbers. It's about eternity. It's about transcendence. About getting beyond the whole, all things. It's ultimately about heaven. If you read Revelation, it's, you have all these sevens and seven trumpets, seven angels, seven. But then the last two chapters, it's something else. It's the eighth day. It's about heaven, eternity. And when, if you think about it, when did Messiah rise? Well, he rose on the first day of the week, but that's also the eighth day of the week. It's the day that breaks out of everything. And the when do most believers gather during the week? It's Sunday, but Sunday is also the eighth day. We are children of the eighth day. And there's several. This is one of the streams in the Book of Mystery, one of them that actually talks about how you can live in the eighth day even now. We're called to live in the heavenlies now. And one of the things is that the word for the symbol of the Spirit in the Bible is, one of them, is shemen, is oil. And oil, the word in Hebrew, is shemen. Shemen actually is linked to the number eight, like the eighth day, because eight is the number that breaks through. You live above and beyond and over and transcending. So there's actually a way to live in the eighth day now. We will live it forever, but there's a way to do it now.
Yeah. All right. How about some of the other Hebrew mysteries, Hebrew truths that you open up in the book? Maybe give a sample of a couple.
Real quick. Yeah, there's so much in the Hebrew and the Greek, but that you don't see you won't see in English or in your translation. But one of them is that there's a certain group of words that are only rendered plural. I mean, only. And for instance, the word for mercy, which we take as God's love, is rachamim, is plural always. The word for sin is singular, but his love and mercy over is plural. No matter how much sin we have, his love is always more. His mercy is always more. We can never exhaust it. And all and won't go into, but all these pluralities, these special, unique words, actually come together in heaven in an incredible way. The word for Jerusalem is plural. The word for heaven is plural. And amazing, meaning there's no end.
Mm. Yeah, and you know, some of the words that you mentioned, Elohim earlier, Rachamim, it points to, in the Semitic languages, in Hebrew, when something is you want to express a fullness, an intensity, that it opens up like that, or Shemayim, which is actually dual,
yes.
The different
yes.
parts. I mean, it's
yes.
it's interesting. All right, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Mike.
No, I'm just wondering if we tell you what. Let's try one more.
Or I can just mention some of them if you want, and not
yeah,
go
yeah.
into,
okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's some that are the mysteries of Eden, and one that links up to that the day that Messiah rose on, and won't go into, but is actually called the day of Genesis, and it's actually the new beginning, as if a new creation entirely. There's a mystery that from the Hebrew Bible that actually gives the very starting day of America. The mystery of America is linked to a Hebrew day and a Hebrew mystery. And there's things also about how to find God's will and calling for your life and how to find your destiny. At one point, the teacher takes the student to a mountain and says, you have to get to the top, the very one point on the top, how do you do it? Well, he gives them a secret, how do you find God's will for your life and your destiny, no matter where you are, even if you don't even know what God's will is, how do you do it? And it's linked to a Hebrew word, which, of course, you and I know, called Aliyah.
Aha. Aliyah, going up.
Yeah. There's a mystery called the Haftorah mystery, which is that every week there's an appointed scripture from ancient times read in the synagogues and appointed for that particular Sabbath. Well, on the day that Israel was born, it was actually a Sabbath, and on that day there was an appointed scripture from ancient times for that day, and the scripture was amazing, appointed, it's all about the birth of Israel that was appointed for that day.
Interesting. All right, tell you what, I think we're out of time, which means you've whet the appetite of the reader. And obviously, people can dive in anywhere. But
yes.
how do you think the book is most effectively read? One chapter a day or just dive
I think,
in?
I think if you have self-control, you can do one at a time. You can do one day at a time. Because I think if you really, there's so much in there, it's concentrated, you digest it, there's so much, and then apply it. I believe, and I don't often say, I believe if you truly take this journey and apply it each day, it'll literally change your life. But you can read it right through, and you can read it, you can skip around. And actually, another thing is that they're actually geared to the biblical year, that if you take it, you know, around the time of the holiday, you'll have something on the holy day that got in. And some of that we didn't even plan. It just fell on the exact day.
Right, and we're coming very near to the high holy day season on the biblical calendar.
Yeah.
Jonathan, I'm thrilled to see the success the book is already having, and
you,
above
Mike.
All, that it's impacting lives.
Yeah.
May God equip us for the days ahead.
Absolutely. Thank you, Michael. It's always a joy. And keep up the great work. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir. All right. Speaking with Jonathan Kahn, his new book, The Book of Mysteries. Again, you can order it with this one-hour interview we've done, plus free with it as well. We'll also give you my mini book, Seven Secrets of the Real Messiah. It's a great tool for Jewish outreach and a real eye-opener for you. Now here's what's interesting. Jonathan is a sober servant of the Lord. I've known him for years. He's a serious messianic leader of a congregation and very serious about the things of God, very serious about concerns about divine judgment on America, very serious about bringing a wake-up call to the church, very serious about addressing the phenomenon of anti-Semitism, and also with a ministry, Hope of the World, that is involved with reaching out to people in different nations and needy people in different nations. I've had folks critical of me, well, it's sensationalistic, or how could you have him on? That's why I urge you to dig in and see for yourself, because what you'll see is that Jonathan is very serious about exalting Yeshua, very serious about preparing God's people, and very serious about getting you into the Word. And that, to me, is the most exciting thing of all. You'll dig, you'll make discovery, your heart will be changed. And, hey, here's the other thing to consider. From God's perspective, he's had a clock ticking the whole time. And could it be that there's significance to the biblical calendar, to the holy days of Scripture, which are still being fulfilled? still yet to be fulfilled with the return of Yeshua and the establishment of his kingdom on the earth. And like everything, dig, sift, study, and come to your own conclusions. So when you get this hardcover volume, the Book of Mysteries, we'll pay the postage. We'll give you free this one-hour interview and free my mini-book, Seven Secrets of the Real Messiah. And you also help us when you order from our website. Help us with this very broadcast that I know has been a blessing to you. So go right now to thelineoffire.org. You can also check out our latest articles, video resources, and place your order today, as many copies as you like. My bottom line today, dig into the Word, live soberly before God, and be prepared for whatever is coming your way. Well, she was raised by lesbian parents, but she now believes that what God's Word says about marriage and family is the best.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Some months back, maybe sometime last year, I came across some fabulous interviews with a woman named Katie Faust, and was just thrilled to see how she communicated, the clarity of her thought, the mingling together of love and truth, and then discovered the website Ask the Bigot. Ask the Bigot. And realize, this is the same person. So in a few minutes, I'm going to bring Katie on to the air for you to meet and hear and interact with. And I think you're going to be really blessed by this interview today. This is Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Some years back when I began to speak more and more about moral and cultural revolution, gospel-based moral and cultural revolution, many of you may have listened or read that or heard me and said, what does he mean? Why do we need a moral and cultural revolution? Yeah, I mean, America's got problems like everybody else. We've always had problems. But what's he talking about? And as the years have gone on, it's become clearer and clearer and clearer. In North Carolina, the NCAA is now bullying the state and saying, because you want to keep a boy out of the girls' locker room, or because you want to have an expectation of privacy for a six-year-old kindergarten girl, we're going to punish you for that. And it's interesting that the NCAA has men's teams and women's teams. What if there was a top male athlete who said that he was a woman, genuinely believed he was a woman? Say the top incoming freshman basketball player in college said that he really believed he was a woman, and he wanted to play on the women's basketball team. Would the NCAA say no? Well, that's what they want the schools to do, high schools and junior high schools, middle schools, and they're punishing North Carolina for that very thing, for saying, no, a boy shouldn't play on the girls' team. And Hillary Clinton now tweeted this out. The NCAA is right to pull tournament games from North Carolina because of the anti-LGBT HB2 law. Discrimination has no place in America. Well, how about the discrimination against all of those who don't identify as transgender and are put out by this? How about the discrimination, say, in a Target store against the women and young ladies that go into the changing room and encounter a biological male in there with them? How about the door that gets open to the heterosexual predator who thinks, cool, I'm going to put a dress on and check out the ladies today? This is so biased, so bigoted. It is such an example of bullying. It must be addressed. But how do we address these things? Well, at the same time, acting and speaking with compassion to those who differ with us. How do we address those who are hurting and who have questions? That's what I'm going to take up with my guest, Katie Faust. David French wrote this: is the trend now that major sporting events can only occur in progressive approved locations? Will we now be subject to a parade of progressive approved and only progressive approved player demonstrations? and spearheading the argument that our sporting culture is opening itself up to free expression. I'm glad neither the NFL nor the San Francisco 49ers are punishing Colin Kaepernick, but just ask Curt Schilling how much the progressive sports elite values dissent from the social justice orthodoxy. The famous Boston Red Sox pitcher, of course, got fired from ESPN for expressing his politically incorrect views. French continues, I don't mind if individual players or owners express themselves so long as it is clearly understood that all viewpoints are welcome. I mind, however, when the sporting elite decides to turn professional and college athletics into a sweatier version of a progressive college campus, speech codes and all. I mind when social justice warriors try to wield the awesome economic power of sports, built via the pocketbooks of all Americans, to punish conservatives, especially Christian conservatives. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Some time back, I discovered to my delight two different people, to find out that the two different people actually was one person. First, Katie Faust, I had discovered, watched some clips of her responding in a critical environment with clarity, with love, with truth. And then found the Ask the Bigot blog spot and said, oh, the same person. Katie is a state leader at Canavox, blogger at Ask the Bigot, and on the Academic Council for the International Children's Rights Institute. She's a Christian, mother of four, pastor's wife, and was raised by two moms, and yet in that sense is uniquely qualified to address these issues of marriage and family. Katie, it's an absolute delight to have you on the Line of Fire.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, my joy. First, before we get into the key issues and get your perspective on these things, what makes you uniquely qualified to address some of the pressing moral and cultural issues when it comes to marriage and family?
Well, thanks for the opportunity to begin here, because I don't present myself as someone that was raised by two moms. My parents were married until I was 10. They fought very hard to keep their marriage together. After the divorce, I split time between their two homes, and at that point, my mom met and fell in love with another woman, and so I would, you know, be with the two of them when I was with my mom and then with my dad the other half of the time. And while I did not consider my mom's partner a mother, I did consider her my friend, and have loved them throughout their relationship. But thankfully, my parents were able to work out an arrangement where I didn't lose contact with either one of them. And so, as I talked about, I filed an amicus brief for the Obergefell case that went before the Supreme Court last year, and spent a good amount of time in that brief talking about the unique and distinct impact that my father had on my life, even after the divorce. So I don't think I can speak from a perspective that many children with same-sex parents come from, because many of those children were raised in an environment where their other biological parent was excluded from their home. And that wasn't my case. But what I can do is speak from the perspective of somebody who sees the goodness of man-woman marriage and fathers and mothers raising their children together and having a deep and fierce love for the LGBT community.
Yes. And thank you for clarifying the sloppiness of the way I presented things. I do appreciate that.
Oh, no problem. It's a kind of shorthand, but I just want to make sure that everyone's getting a real fair picture here.
Right. So the benefit that you do have is that you can see, in that sense, through both windows. You can see past the caricatures against many LGBT people and the way LGBT parents may be caricatured by critics. And you can also see the importance of having both a mother and a father. And as well, the third window you can look through is the one of the trauma of divorce and the challenges of that. So speak candidly to me and to our audience, Katie. You're involved on the front lines of what could be called the culture wars. And yet I'm sure you often see a lack of love, lack of compassion, lack of empathy from our side in terms of LGBT community.
Well, I didn't want to wade into the waters of speaking about this publicly. And, of course, when I began blogging, it was anonymous. But I was tearing my hair out because I felt like on our side of the equation, either people were forsaking truth so that they could embrace people in love, which, of course, is important to recognize the value and dignity and worth of everybody, or they were falling so hard on the side of truth that they were closing their hearts to our LGBT brothers and sisters. And so for me, just speaking biblically and then from a practical perspective of interacting with and loving people on all different sides of this issue, the conclusion that I came to is, especially if you call yourself a Christian, especially if you consider yourself biblical, there is only one way to deal with this issue, and that is hold on to truth with all of your might and do not compromise one bit, and run after and love with reckless abandon those people that disagree with you, especially the LGBT community. And the truth is that you have to do both, right? That there has to be complete love, and I would say initiating relationships with our LGBT friends and family, and not giving up one iota of the truth about marriage and sexuality. And so that's a really hard balance because most of us are either grace givers or truth tellers, and we tend to major on one or the other, but the reality is that all of us have to do both. So I began writing about this because I didn't see those two ends of the spectrum being spoken about and acted on by many in this debate.
Yeah, and when God began to lay this on my heart in 2004 to get involved in these issues, because there's nothing in my own background that would connect me to this, but when I realized it was a pressing issue in our society, I began to look at the issue, and as I began to look at the issue, I said I need to find out about the people, and hence my heart broke for the people, while my resolve stiffened in terms of standing up for truth. And though it was laid on my heart was reach out to the people with compassion, resist the agenda with courage, or put another way, we need hearts of compassion and backbones of steel. And Katie, I've appreciated, and I may even play a couple of clips, seeing you in some somewhat hostile or critical settings that you respond, you're never on the defensive, you respond with dignity and with love and with truth, and yet you're still going to be called a bigot because you don't affirm homosexual practice as being right or best. You don't believe that two dads or two moms is best for a child. So because you don't celebrate same-sex, quote, marriage, you are therefore a bigot, hence the blog title. So how do we overcome that?
Well, I think that you need to give up. I think all of us, you know, that's the whole point of why I began blogging under that name, as you can might be able to guess. It was kind of born in an angry moment because I realized there really isn't anything that I can do to not be a bigot. The only way to not be a bigot is to toe the line of sexual progressive hook, line, and sinker, right? That, like, just swallow it and accept it and shill for it. Otherwise, you're a bigot, right? It doesn't matter whether or not you have principled, well-reasoned, secularly articulated arguments for this. It doesn't matter that you love and accept and reach out to the gay and lesbians in your life. It doesn't matter, right? You are a bigot if you don't agree with this one very polarizing tenet of pop culture. And so that's where I just said, okay, fine. If you think that me supporting traditional marriage simply makes me a bigot, then look at my life. Look at my life, right? And so that's the point, is for people that come to the blog or my Twitter account or my public Facebook feed, you know, whatever it is, that they would see somebody that holds on to truth, that it's grounded in natural law, the best social science, and that respects the dignity and worth of everybody involved in the discussion.
Yeah, so friends, you can go to askthebigot.com. And yeah, Hebrews 13, let us go outside the camp bearing the reproach he bore. Just accept the fact that unless you totally toe the line with the latest PC correctness, you're going to be characterized that way. And then you have to overcome that with the conduct of your life, the words that you say. How can folks connect with you on Twitter or Facebook?
Well, I'm at Twitter at Ask the Bigot. And, you know.
It works. It works.
Yeah. It wasn't a handle that was taken. And I'm blogging these days. I'm just coming off a summer break where there wasn't a whole lot of productivity, but I'm back in the saddle. So, yeah, I didn't get into this debate because I hate being called names. I like to be liked, and I hate to be hated, and I just didn't want people to not like me. But it got to the point where I realized, you know, the other side is dominating this discussion because ordinary people like me don't want to have to deal with the rancor that goes along with this debate. And as a result, I feel like we kind of handed it to the other side. Mm. And so there is no way to avoid it. You will be called names. People will not like you. But this cause is worth it because I think as you and I are going to discuss, this really is not about adults. This entire discussion about marriage is really about children and the rights and well-being of children. And if there is anything that Christians especially, but in general all adults, should be for, it is protecting the rights and well-being of the most vulnerable among us. I think that maybe people don't understand the depth and the importance of this issue because it has been framed in a way that focuses on adult desires rather than child rights.
Right. So what we hear, and we're going to focus the rest of our interview on the children. What we hear constantly is, hey, if two men or two women want to marry, how does that affect your marriage? Which is really not the question, because if someone's single, if someone's sleeping with their boyfriend or girlfriend, if someone has three ladies living in the house with a guy, if someone's committing adultery, how does that affect your marriage? That's really the wrong question to ask. But in reality, it does end up affecting everyone. So I want to come back and focus in on the issue of the children. That's why Katie does what she does. Go to askthebigot.com to find out more. Connect with her on Twitter, AskTheBigot. We'll find out about the Academic Council for the International Children's Rights Institute. We'll find out about Canavox. We'll find out about the five basic rights for every child.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Now, how is it that the daughter of lesbian mothers has become a leading opponent of gay marriage? How does that work?
Well, simply because I recognize that while my mother was a fantastic mother, and most of what I do well as a mother myself, I do because that's how she parented me, she can't be a father. Her partner, an incredible woman, both of these women have my heart, cannot be a father either. Children have a right to be in relationship with their mother and father whenever possible. And as a society, we shouldn't normalize a family structure that requires children to lose one or both parents to be in that household.
That is the voice of Katie Faust as I watched this clip from last year on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation broadcast with Tony Jones from last December. I was cheering her on for the clarity of speech, for the love that she expresses for her mother and the partner that raised her part of her life, and for her clarity on why this really matters. Katie, I've said the world's best mother is not a father, and the world's best father is not a mother, thinking it's pretty self-evident, only to get howls of criticism. But it doesn't get much more basic than that, does it?
No. And I think that in this quest for equality that the left has pushed so significantly in recent years, what they've had to come to the point of saying that you're not equal unless you're the same. And there's this incredible minimizing of gender differences, right? And the need to say that really men and women are interchangeable, you know, from that stems these debates and discussions we're having about transgenderism, you know, that gender is fluid. But the truth is, obviously, that it takes a man and a woman to make a baby. And those are also the ideal conditions within which to raise the child because fathers and mothers offer distinct and complementary benefits to children, and children have a right to both their mother and father. And so my whole goal is to try and help people understand these issues from the child's perspective rather than an adult-centric perspective.
You wrote a letter that went viral. Dear Justice Kennedy, an open letter from the child of a loving gay parent in February of 2015. And of course, that was part of the amicus brief submitted to the Supreme Court last year. Were you surprised with the response to your letter and to the degree that it circulated? Or does it make sense? Because yes, you're articulating what many are feeling.
Well, yes. I was surprised, totally, because I'm not anybody special. I'm not saying anything that anybody cannot say, right? I'm stating basic fundamental truth. I just think that people had not considered this discussion from the child's perspective, and that simply is that government's interest in marriage is not your love life. Government's interest in marriage does not have to do with whom you share love and connection. Government's interest in marriage is that children come from a man and a woman, and that statistically we know that children fare best when they are raised in an intact, married, low-conflict household. And therefore, government should incentivize men, especially committing to the women with whom they are making children. If you do so, you are drastically going to reduce rates of poverty and high incarceration, and you're going to improve academic performance for children. There's major social fallout for society when we abandon these norms of gendered marriage. But I think that people had not considered the cost to children, because when you redefine marriage, you redefine parenthood. Since government's interest in marriage is children, not affirming a lifestyle or giving an endorsement to your romantic connections, government's interest in marriage is children. Therefore, redefining marriage redefines parenthood. What that means is children who grow up within a same-sex headed household will grow up missing half of their heritage, with at least one parent who is not biologically related to them. They will lose out on the incredible benefits of male and female love in their household, and that it's an injustice to the child to normalize that kind of family structure for kids. And I think that that article was widely shared because people had not considered that there was a cost to kids. We had looked at this so much through the lens of adult desires, and saying things like, well, what are you saying, that LGBT people can't be good parents? I'm not saying that. I'm saying that women can't be men and men can't be women. I'm saying that women can't father and men don't mother, and kids need both. And I'm saying that you can't minimize the importance of a biological connection when you're talking about parenthood. So I just think that article in particular presented it in a way that people hadn't thought of before.
Yeah, and tell us about Canavox. Many people are certainly not familiar with this.
Yeah, Canavox is new, and it's fantastic. Canavox, in my opinion, is what is going to change the culture. It is a grassroots marriage organization that develops reading groups all around the United States and the world for people who want to study all of these issues that are affecting marriage and sexuality in the pop culture right now. Because I think that the left has rightly criticized conservatives for saying, well, you don't seem to care about all these other things affecting marriage and family, but suddenly gay marriage comes up and you're, you know, chewing the carpet about it. But the reality is that we've got all kinds of issues that those of us who love marriage understand the benefit to the individual, child, and society. There's all kinds of things that are assaulting that family structure, which is the building block of you know, our entire society, whether it's pornography or divorce or cohabitation or, you know, the sex ed curriculum that's being presented to our children. We need to educate ourselves in a way where we can then go out and be the change, be the effective ambassadors for the truth in our social sphere, in our schools, in our neighborhoods, even in our churches. And so Canavox equips women and men, but it's definitely a mother-led organization, to understand these issues. We do it in a way that uses natural law, and so we have reading groups that are Muslim. We have a Jewish leader. We've got Mormon reading groups, lots of Catholic reading groups, and then, you know, some evangelicals as well. And all of us are reading these readings on these different topics that rely on natural law and social science and common sense, paired with personal stories, so that you really get a sense of understanding the issues that are impacting marriage and family and sexuality today. And it's almost as if we create a haven of free speech where women can get together and understand these so they can better go out and discuss it with their friends and equip their children to stand firm too. And of course, it has the fantastic benefit of strengthening your own marriage as well, because we have reading sessions on marital intimacy and communication in marriage and friendship in marriage so that our marriages can be what they are supposed to be as well. And understanding, too, that the strength of our marriage can impact society as a whole.
Yeah, what a great grassroots concept. And thanks for getting my pronunciation right on that. What's the way for folks to connect with this?
Canavox.com. You can go there. You can read about our vision, mission. You can read this, look at the syllabus and the incredible women who are leading this venture. It truly is grassroots, and it's the most exciting thing in my life. I love it.
Wow. I'm thrilled to pass this on to our listeners. Canavox.com. Everybody go there. Moms in particular, head over there. We'll announce it again. More to come with Katie Faust.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
The question is, what is government's interest in marriage? It's really not about affirming the connections that we have with one another. It has to do with the product of those unions. And there's something distinct about the product of a union between heterosexuals. What's distinct is that they make babies, and those babies have rights, and those babies deserve protection.
That's the voice of Katie Faust. She's on this interview with December 8th, 2015 on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation broadcast. Katie blogs at askthebigot.com. And is an enthusiastic participant of Canavox, Giving Marriage a Voice. You can find out more about that at canavox.com. I'm looking at the website right now. Katie, in short, marriage conveys benefits on society, namely producing children for the next generation, joining those children to a mother and father. So society conveys benefits on marriage. If not for that, government has no business getting involved with who you date, who you love, who you room with, or whatever. So government's looking at this on a pragmatic level. But let's focus now on children. If you can do this in 3 or 4 minutes, you have articulated through the Academic Council for the International Children's Rights Institute 5 basic rights. At least let's get started on this. What are the rights of children?
So as the International Children's Rights Institute kind of enumerates here, there are some fundamental rights, and unfortunately the term children's rights has to be taken back because the left has used that almost to mean children's sexual rights.
Yes.
But there are foundational rights spoken about, outlined in the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, which is the most widely ratified treaty in the world, and it begins with a child's right to live. It is followed by a child's right to be in connection with her mother and father. These are foundational rights, followed up by a child's right to be born free and not bought and sold, to not be considered a commodity. Everything needed to have a basic standard of existence, and a child's right to be protected from abuse and exploitation, the right to modesty. And at Canavox, you know, we also recognize a child's right to be raised according to their biological gender. So it's peeling back a little bit of the ideological narrative that has been thrown out there about children and getting down to the bare bones basics. They have a right to live. They have a right to not be arbitrarily separated from their parents. They have a right to not be commodified and bought and sold. They have a right to modesty and protection. And so that's, you know, children don't get to lobby and organize and you know, blog. And adults are the ones that have been dominating most of these conversations. But when we get right down to the heart of children's basic rights, that's what they are. And if we respect child rights, that means that adults need to accommodate those rights rather than stripping children of these rights that they are born with, that deserve protection, and asking those children to fit into their lifestyle. And I'm not just talking about gays and lesbians. I am talking about anybody that is making decisions and lifestyle choices that ask children to sacrifice these fundamental rights.
Yeah, and we've got a short segment here. We'll continue this on the other side of the break. But as I'm looking at the Canavox website and scrolling down looking at state leaders, I see your picture for Washington State right next to someone who I've had on the air in years past, Alana from Louisiana, and the Anonymous Us Project. So these are children of anonymous sperm donors who are disconnected from fathers, and the poems and the stories on that website are moving. I read one of them just about broke down on the air. So these kids, just because you can have these sperm banks and anonymous donors, don't even have the right to know who the father is. I mean, it's outrageous, and the impact that it has on them for life. So this is all about the children. When we come back, I want to ask specifically, what about, we hear all these reports that two moms, two dads, just as good as a mom and dad. How does Katie respond to that?
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You may have read last year an open letter to Justice Kennedy from a woman who, for part of her upbringing, was raised by her mother and a partner. Mother and father divorced at 10, so she divided time between her father's home and her mother's home. And for some of that time, her mother had a partner. And she wrote an open letter to Justice Kennedy about the importance of not redefining marriage. You may have gone to her blog, askthebigot.com. Yes, because you're called a bigot when you say that marriage is the union of a man and a woman and a kid should have a mom and dad. Hence, askthebigot.com. My guest, Katie Faust. Katie, we hear this all the time. Well, the latest research indicates that kids do just fine with two moms or two dads. In some cases, they do even better than with a mom and a dad. And wouldn't you rather have a kid with two loving moms or two loving dads rather than, say, with an alcoholic father who beats the mother? You've heard all this over and over. How do you respond in terms of data, in terms of experience?
Yeah, I think that's such a great question. You know, studies are tough because if you haven't had a chance to really, really look into things, you can just say, well, one study says this and one study says that, so what are you going to believe? But if you actually look at the studies that report no difference between children who are raised in intact married homes with their mother and father and children raised with same-sex couples, the ones that say that there's no difference, in general, use very small sample sizes. They do not use participants who were, derived randomly. They tend to be recruited or volunteers, mm-hmm. and as any good researcher knows, the outcomes are going to be skewed, probably, if somebody goes into it knowing what the study's about and with an intention to give an answer that is going to have a favorable outcome. If you instead have longitudinal studies that study kids for the long term, that use massive data samples, and that are randomly derived, when you look at those studies, overwhelmingly, the data supports that children raised in intact married homes with their mother and father in low-conflict marriages fare the best. And so I will present it differently to people. I'll say, you know, when you're not talking about same-sex parenting, social scientists tend to agree on several things. Number one, that biological parents tend to be the most invested and attached and connected to and permanent and stable in a child's life. Number two, they recognize that mothers and fathers offer complementary benefits to children. Number three, that non-biological parents tend to be more transitory, less invested, and more dangerous in a child's life. And number four, that anytime there's separation from parent to child, whether it's abandonment, divorce, third-party reproduction, or death, that there's trauma, and that impacts child development. So how is it that when those four factors are involved and you're not studying same-sex parenting, social scientists discover diminished outcomes for children? But suddenly when you study same-sex parenting, even though all four of those are going to be a factor, now there's no difference in child mm-hmm. outcomes. that's where you have to say, okay, there must be something else going on here than simple research and data collection, right? That obviously this has been so politicized, and there's been an incentive for researchers to come to a certain conclusion that the studies that we have are not giving us the unvarnished truth. Dr. Paul Sullins did a huge study using data from the National Institute of Health. It was a longitudinal study. It came out early this year, I think in June, and it showed an incredible deficit for children, especially in the area of mental health, later on in adulthood for kids that were raised with same-sex couples. And the data size, the pool of participants was vast compared to some of these other studies that were done that reported no difference. You know, some of them would have 40 or 80 participants, and this one had tens of thousands. So you really have to look at the study to know whether or not to give weight to it or not.
Yeah, and there was one recent study that I saw that asked the parents their perceptions on how the kids were doing. And then it's been kind of an in-house secret that kids raised by same-sex parents were more likely to experience gender confusion, more likely to experience homosexual attraction themselves, more right. likely to challenge gender boundaries and things. But that was considered good, so that was never reported as a deficit. And then if you dare challenge the party line, like Professor Mark Regnerus did or something like that, it could cost you your job or your reputation. So people really need to examine this carefully. So, Katie, when you became a Christian, it took you a while, as a young woman coming to faith, it took you a while to fully embrace what Scripture said because of your love for your mom and her partner. Is that an overstatement or a misstatement of your experience?
No, it took me a while to get on board with biblical sexuality. You know, I knew that Jesus died for me and that he loved me, but I wasn't ready to then say, and there is a pattern for, you know, human sexuality that goes along with this. And there's some protectiveness there. But the good news is that the reality is that Christ, is seeking us all. And that the reality of the gospel means that everybody, regardless of their relationship status or sexual feeling, is worth seeking after, pursuing, sacrificing for. And so that biblical worldview exalts the worth of everybody involved in this debate. And so it's not one that diminishes certain people and exalts others. It's one that exalts Christ and then recognizes everyone as image bearers.
Yes, absolutely. All created in God's image, Jesus died for each and every one equally, every one of us equally in need of redemption. The human race fallen, broken, outside of the Messiah. Katie, you could address this last question for hours, but in the few minutes we have left, the difference between a mother and a father, what does each one bring that's unique in a child's upbringing?
You're right. You could go on for hours and hours and hours. But I will say that my husband just posted this picture on Facebook yesterday about a memory from 2 years ago where he took the kids through this kind of wilderness area near our house, and they were climbing a cliff and they got stuck, right? So then he had to come home and get rope and then like put the rope, you know, get the rope down to the kids and they had to climb up, and it was just this huge adventure. And men tend to bring risk and push boundaries and teach justice to children in ways that women don't. Why is that? Because the aggressive center of their brain is 2.5 times larger than women's, who tend to focus more on the immediate emotional well-being of their kids. You know, you go to the play equipment and you can see it. You know, the kid falls down and bumps himself and the mom's over there going, oh, baby, are you okay? And the dad's like, come on, do it again. Next time you're going to make it. Uh-huh. And so that men and women are so different, obviously translates to how they parent, whether it's reading stories. You know, men tend to read stories to their kids full of imagination and using different voices. They play differently. They discipline differently. And children are made for the daily input of both their father and their mother. Neither one is expendable. Neither of them are optional. Both are critical.
Yeah, and with that, if you have, say, a single-parent home, there's a recognition of a deficit and the possibility of that being filled. Let's say one of the parents dies early. You have the possibility of remarriage, but there's a recognition of a deficit, whereas with a same-sex household, by definition, you are excluding the input and involvement of either the mother or the father by very definition. Katie, give us one last pitch for our listeners for Canavox.com. Why should they go there? What can they benefit from?
Well, I love Canavox because I think a lot of us look at what's going on in the world and we go, oh my gosh, this is so crazy. What can I do? I'm not a blogger. I'm not a politician. I'm just a mom or, you know, I'm just a teacher or whatever. This is what you can do, right? You can come here, you get your friends together and you study this and you understand it and you arm yourself with good information and you do it in a relational environment, in a organization that is very serious about responding with cheerfulness and solutions and recognizing the worth of everybody involved in these conversations, that this is something that everyone can do. And when you're done with the readings, when you go through the syllabus, you feel so much more comfortable talking about these things with your friend, approaching the school administrators at your school when there's something questionable in sex ed, talking with your librarian about, you know, things that you see on the shelves there, or writing your congressman or whatever it is. There are a million things that the layman can do to turn this around. But it means being armed with good information and doing it in a way that is compassionate and relevant. And that's what Canavox equips you and me and everyone to do. So I'd say if you're feeling like, I want to do something, I want to make a difference, I don't know what it is, this is what you need to do.
Awesome. Yeah, and Katie, I was unaware of the site and the resource until now, so I will absolutely recommend it. And it has to be like this. It has to be grassroots, moms, dads, educators, people at work, wherever. How can I get involved? How can I make a difference? Keep up the great work. By God's grace, the tide will turn.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
You are very welcome. All right, friends, check it out. Go to canavox.com. Find out more to connect with Katie directly. AskTheBigot.com. We'll be right back.
Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to the Line of Fire. 866-34-TRUTH is our number, but I haven't even given it out all day because I've had interviews on the first hour and 45 minutes plus of the broadcast. If you missed any of the broadcast, just go to thelineoffire.org, thelineoffire.org. And when you're there, just look at today's show. Just click on listen. And within hours of the broadcast, it's archived for you. And it's archived free of charge. You don't have to pay a subscription price to get it. Our podcasts are also free. But that's with your help. That's with your support. We are able to do what we do. I want to totally change gears for a moment. You may have heard during the presidential campaign, you may have heard about Chris Christie and what was called Bridgegate. And I have on the air with me now Paul Larkin. He directs the Heritage Foundation's project to counter abuse of the criminal law, particularly at the federal level, a senior legal research fellow in the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. And Paul's written an article that is relevant to this discussion, and I want to bring you up to date. You may not have heard what's been going on, but Paul, welcome to the broadcast. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
First, give us a little history about this, and then why you wrote this article today.
Back in 2013, Governor Christie was running for re-election. And like all politicians, he was trying to round up support. One of the local politicians in Fort Lee declined to endorse him. And some of, as the story goes, and some of Christie's staff in response decided that they needed to slow down some traffic to create traffic jams on the bridges. It wound up becoming quite a brouhaha around that time. And it wound up bringing a lot of public criticism on the staff and on the governor. The problem is the federal government now has tried to turn what is essentially a stupid political dirty trick into a federal felony. That's absurd. They charged him with theft. They didn't steal anything. the bridge is still there. Traffic is probably there, too. They didn't misuse anybody's time unless the Justice Department thinks that using the phone to call a sick parent is a misuse and therefore theft of somebody's property. It certainly didn't violate anyone's civil rights. That there's no traffic clause in the Constitution. There may be in some constitutions, and if there is, it probably comes right after the sanity clause. But there isn't in this one, and so bringing this charge is simply an abuse of government power.
Do you think there's any political motivation to it, with Christie being associated with Donald Trump, or is there a larger issue in your view?
Well, I don't have any evidence to support that, but if I was a district court judge and somebody presented this indictment, I would have my doubts. This is something that would, I think, justify asking the government why. Why did you need to prosecute these people for what they did here?
Mm. All right, you have an article, Bridgegate was stupid, not criminal, DOJ indictment oversteps. It's in the Daily Signal. Again, this is Paul Larkin. You can read this by going to dailysignal.com. Paul, there is a part of the Heritage Foundation, a project specifically seeking to counter abuse of criminal law, particularly at the federal level. Why do you need to exist? Why does this department or project need to exist?
Unfortunately, we have misused, abused, and otherwise poorly handled criminal justice policy for quite some time. It's been a problem for Republicans and Democrats. We ask the criminal law to do too much. Oftentimes what we do is use the criminal law to go after people that we are angry at rather than people we are afraid of. And that creates all sorts of problems. The public doesn't know what is and isn't a crime. It's a misuse of government resources. It creates tragedies if people get convicted of conduct that no reasonable person would have thought was a crime. And it allows the government to abuse its power.
Yeah, and then if we look at the Department of Justice and, say, beginning back with Eric Holder, so the previous attorney general, and you look at some of the selective use of the law, for example, Attorney General Holder telling other attorneys general that if he were them, he would not enforce laws upholding marriages, male and female, just as he wouldn't have upheld laws of segregation. So you've got kind of an abuse on one side and then an abuse on the other side. How do we sort this out as Americans? What's the role of the Department of Justice in all of this?
Well, the Justice Department takes its lead from the Attorney General, and the Attorney General takes his or her lead from the President. In theory, the best attorney generals are the ones whom the president knows in advance. At least I think so. Because the president wants an attorney general who he can trust, who's going to be advancing the president's agenda, not the attorney general's own. Plus, what the president needs is an attorney general that can say no to him. But it's the president and the attorney general that make policy. And the way you change policy at the Justice Department is to change both of them. We have an election coming up in November, and it's likely we'll have a new attorney general in January.
All right. So if you were looking at things with a Hillary Clinton coming into presidency, what kind of attorney general might you expect?
In all truth, I really don't know.
Okay.
But what I can say is whether it's Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, it's very important we have an attorney general who realizes that the government can't abuse its authority, and we need an attorney general who will make sure that won't happen.
Is there any way for Americans to push back? Because it can feel frustrating, and then you have a voice through Heritage, the Heritage Foundation. Folks, that's heritage.org if you haven't taken advantage of all the resources there. But what can Americans do? Because it can be frustrating, and the power of the federal government is very intimidating.
Well, what the average person can do is first vote, and vote for someone who you think is going to represent your interest and is going to make sure that the government doesn't abuse its authority. Secondly, speak out or write. Write in blogs, write in magazines, write to newspapers. Do whatever you can to make sure that your voice is heard by people on Capitol Hill, in the executive branch, and in the courts, that you think the government is abusing its authority. People should speak out over and over and over if they think the government is acting improperly.
Yeah, and these days, everyone can have a voice. And friends, if you say, I don't know what to say, well, Go to heritage.org. You'll get equipped. You'll find out what to say in terms of here are the facts, here are the issues, think them through, and articulate it in your own words. And to find out more, because you're going to be hearing a lot about this in the news about Bridgegate, go to dailysignal.com. Bridgegate was stupid, not criminal. DOJ indictment oversteps by my guest, Paul Larkin. Hey, we're out of time, but thanks so much for coming on and filling us in on this issue.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Well, friends, we are right out of time. If you missed my interview in the first hour with Jonathan Kahn, please, by all means, check it out. You can get the interview, exclusive one-hour interview on his new book, The Book of Mysteries. Get the interview for free. Hardcover book will pay the postage on it as well and give you free my mini book, which you cannot buy elsewhere, Seven Secrets of the Real Messiah. So, thelineoffire.org. Go there, order at your heart's content, get as many as you want coming for the holidays. My bottom line today, yeah, government can be strong, powerful, going in the wrong direction, but we each have a voice.